On October 29th, 1918, only a few days before the official end of World War I, in Kiel, a naval port on Germany's northern coast, sailors in the German Imperial Navy staged a mutiny that would spark revolutions across Germany, would lead to the formation of a new state with a constitution recognizing radical new human rights, and ultimately would lead to the rise of the Nazi Party. The sailors were responding to the unauthorized decision by the German Imperial Naval Command to take the entire fleet and engage in one final suicidal battle against the Royal Navy. The German naval officers believed it was better for the sailors to die gloriously in battle at sea than to escape the upcoming so-called dishonorable peace settlement and go home alive. The sailors, however, thought differently. Welcome to the Weimar Spectacle, where I explore the brief and extraordinary life of the Weimar Republic. I'm Bremner Fletcher, singer, actor, and theater maker. I have spent years performing songs and theater from the Weimar period, and I am inspired and maybe more than a little obsessed by that moment in time. You'll find a transcript of this episode, photographs, and images on my website at bremnersings.com, bremnersings.com. So, my big idea for these podcasts is that the Weimar Republic invented everything about the modern world, and we are all still dealing with the possibilities and problems it gave to us. And to prove this possibly unprovable idea, I will be exploring the arts, the politics, the science, the architecture, and the social innovations of the Weimar period, and the terrifying and irresistible rise of the Nazi Party. So, if you are an amateur astronomer who wants to know why in Potsdam, Germany, there is an innovative astrophysical observatory called the Einstein Tower that is still studied by modern architecture students, or maybe a graphic designer who wants to escape the computer screen, go totally old school and find out exactly what kind of glue George Gross used in his radical and revolutionary collages, well, this is the show for you. So back to the mutiny. About a month before that mutiny, on the 3rd of October 1918, the new German government, led by Prince Max von Baden, began an exchange of diplomatic notes with U.S. President Woodrow Wilson requesting an end to the war. However, the leadership of the German Navy refused to believe Germany was defeated. And over the course of that month, as terms of an armistice were being finalized, the German Navy's highest command set up secret plans for a major assault on the Royal Navy. The German Navy had been held in reserve for most of the war, and they feared that the officer corps would lose honor if the war came to an end without the full deployment of the fleet. They also believed the Navy's glorious sacrifice would reignite the German population's desire to continue the war. However, just as they were about to set sail, sailors on board three ships refused to weigh anchor, and some committed outright mutiny and sabotage. The next day, loyal boats aimed their cannons at those ships, and the mutineers surrendered. But the naval command felt that the crew's loyalty could no longer be relied upon, so the battle squadron was ordered back to Kiel. The sailors were desperately trying to prevent the fleet from setting sail again, and also to find a way to release their comrades. So 250 sailors met in the evening of the 1st of November and sent delegations to their officers requesting the mutineers' release. But instead, their meeting place was closed down by the police and locked, which led to an open-air meeting on the 2nd of November, where the sailors called for a mass meeting the following day. And on the 3rd of November, in the afternoon, several thousand people, along with workers' representatives from various Kiel industries, met under the banner of Peace and Bread, Frieden und Brot, demanding not only the release of the prisoners, but also the end of the war and better food. The Navy was renowned for the terrible, terrible provisions it fed the common sailors and the luxury of the officers' tables. Eventually, this group began to march peacefully towards the military prison, but when soldiers fired live rounds into the marchers, killing 7 people and wounding 30, a protest turned into a revolution. And on the morning of the 4th of November, mutineers moved through the city of Kiel looking for support. Sailors from a large barracks outside the city joined the mutiny, and that day the first Sailors' Council was set up to bring public and military institutions under control. And when the officers broke their promises and sent troops, they were either sent back or they joined the rebellion. So by the evening of the 4th of November, Kiel was in the hands of about 40,000 rebellious sailors, soldiers, and workers. These mutineers set up the first examples of what would be the defining institution of the German Revolution, a workers' council. It was similar to what had happened previously in Russia, where councils called Soviets were set up. Eventually, across Germany, there were factory workers' councils, soldiers' councils, miners' councils, even artist councils. It was a kind of grassroots democracy, not unlike the Occupy Wall Street movement from the 2000s, where groups came together to debate and form policy. In 1918, workers on strike, soldiers who disliked orders, artists planning a new gallery or theater show might elect a council to guide them on how to move forward, and they'd make decisions collectively, delegate members who would negotiate terms with the authorities and who would then come back and report where the next steps would again be decided by the council. As they gained power in cities across Germany, they took charge of civil servants and governing bodies. And they brought a hope of a deep change in a country that had previously been governed in a completely top-down authoritarian system. And as the councils gained power, they raised immense fear and loathing in Germany's ruling classes, partly because just to the east in Russia, they could see the chaos and brutality and repression after that revolution. Also around the 4th of November, delegates from the sailors traveled by train to all the country's big cities, and by the 7th of November, 3 days later, the revolution had seized all the large coastal cities, as well as Hanover, Brunswick, Frankfurt on Main, and Munich. In Munich, a workers' and soldiers' council forced the last king of Bavaria, Ludwig III, to abdicate. And in the following days, the royal rulers of all the German states abdicate. And Kaiser Wilhelm, let me see if I can get this title straight, Kaiser Wilhelm, King of Prussia, Margrave of Brandenburg, Sovereign and Supreme Duke of Silesia, Grand Duke of the Lower Rhine and Posen, Duke of Saxony, Westphalia and Pomerania, of Lunenburg and Bremen, of Holstein, Schleswig and Lauenburg, Landgrave of Hesse, Prince of East Frisia, Osnabrück and Hildesheim, of Nassau and Fulda, Count of Hohenzollern, Lord of Frankfurt, and the last Emperor of Germany, abdicates and leaves the country. But maybe this should not all come as a surprise, because for the generals running Germany's imperial military forces, Germany's desperate situation had been evident for some time. In September 1918, the leaders of Germany's military, Field Marshal Hindenburg and General Erich Ludendorff, began planning an end to the war and a transition to a civilian, limited parliamentary democracy. However, this transition to democracy was not from any sense of democratic ideals. Instead, they had decided that they needed to pass the symbolic responsibility for ending the war and declaring Germany's surrender into the hands of politicians and escape that stain on the officer corps of the army. And with the Kaiser's blessing, in October of 1918, a civilian, limited constitutional government was established. And this attempt to pass responsibility for the surrender worked so successfully that it gave rise to one of Hitler's major talking points, the so-called stab in the back theory, the theory that Germany's successful World War I campaign had been betrayed by Jewish politicians, and if not for them, Germany would have gone on to win World War I. However, in early November 1918, as the Revolutionary Councils spread across Germany and public squares fill with demonstrators, it's evident that larger concessions would need to be made to bleed off the energy from this revolutionary movement. So the head of the provisional civilian government, Prince Max von Baden, who had been set in power by Ludendorff and the Kaiser, passes over control to the head of Germany's moderate, center-left Social Democratic Party. However, this was to be anything but a smooth transition. Instead, in two completely unsanctioned declarations, The head of the Social Democratic Party steps onto the balcony of the Reichstag and declares that from that moment on, Germany is now a republic. And at almost the same time, from a balcony of the Royal Palace, the famed radical socialist and anti-war activist Karl Liebknecht declares that Germany from now on is a socialist republic. And at that point, essentially, all hell breaks loose. Because, you see, Germans at this moment are not simply eager for change. They are a powder keg of gunpowder waiting to explode with change. As World War I is ending, millions of soldiers, many of them traumatized by the brutality of the trenches, are flooding back into the country, often still holding their weapons. And at the same time, since the Kaiser had turned the whole country into a war machine, industries that had been on overdrive to support the war are firing workers and shutting factories. And most of these workers are women, hired during the war to replace men sent to the front. So now, trained, skilled, newly empowered women are being sent back to their villages, partly because the industries are scaling back, but mostly by order of the German government, to allow returning soldiers to step back into their old jobs in the hopes that steady work would diffuse their potential for violence. One manufacturer, Krupp Industries, but by only 3 weeks after the end of the war, has fired 52,000 workers and kicked them out of their industry housing. Of that number, nearly 30,000 are female workers, and only 500 of them get to keep their jobs. However, beyond vaguely hoping that they would find work, the government has no plan on how to reincorporate these traumatized soldiers and newly empowered women back into society. City officials print leaflets telling returning soldiers to keep moving and return to their villages, and that they will be refused any aid and shelter in the cities. However, what the soldiers do instead, and the women, is to involve themselves in the new politics, to join discussion groups in public squares, to form soldiers' and workers' councils of their own, and they are completely inspired by the huge changes happening around them in Bavaria, when the arch-conservative, militaristic, Catholic, reactionary King Ludwig III is overthrown. Workers and soldiers nominate Kurt Eisner, a literary critic, a pacifist and an anti-militarist, as the president of the People's State of Bavaria. So the soldiers, and along with them the women, who are soon to be given the vote for the first time, plunge into politics, demanding respect and new conditions. However, they're not all just moving to the left wing of the political sphere. Oswald Spengler, a conservative, writes, "I am choking with disgust. The way that Kaiser Wilhelm was chased away after sacrificing himself for the greatness of Germany, we need harsh punishments until the time is ready for a small group to be called to leadership. A lot of blood has to flow, the more the better." Many people are moving to the right wing, and some ex-soldiers find a place in the Freikorps. The Freikorps is an unofficial paramilitary group who start a campaign of brutality and assassination, and they were sponsored by the army in response to new restrictions on the size and power of the army. And in a fateful step that would years later come back to haunt them and eventually lead to the downfall of the Weimar Republic and all of its dreams, the new socialist government joins forces with those right-wing paramilitary groups to attack the workers demanding new rights and powers. You see, the SDP, the Social Democratic Party, who now had power after the Kaiser had abdicated, was a center-left liberal party, and they fully intended to implement huge reforms in Germany to bring in better working conditions, ensure health care, empower women, create a working democracy. But they viewed the workers' councils all around Germany as agents of chaos that would prevent those changes. And to be fair to the SDP, just to the east, they could see the Bolshevik Revolution descending into civil war, starvation, and the terrifying brutality of political terror and repression. And also, in typical left-wing fashion, the various factions of the German left, the communists, the socialists, the anarchists, the anarcho-syndicalists, and the Spartacists, had already begun to view each other as enemies almost equal to the old regime. So the SDP was working furiously to try and channel all those competing energies in the hopes of avoiding a civil war. They decide to channel all those forces through the most democratic process available, the popular vote. A brand new constitution will be created for a brand new democracy, and they hope that move will bleed off the popularity of the radical groups and destroy the legitimacy of the workers' councils. They realize that Germany needs to make a massive shift to a modern post-war economy, and also, simply, they need to keep people alive. Food and coal has to be found. People need to be put back to work. Democratic institutions need to be constructed from scratch. However, the problem is that the SDP has never held power. It is filled with very smart people who are brilliant party organizers, but they have no experience in running a state, running the trains, keeping sewers and water working, maintaining a police force. So, to keep chaos in check, the SDP strikes deals with the devil. They make deals with the most conservative elements of the old regime. The old army officer corps will be left in place if they support the new government and supply soldiers to control the workers' councils. Industry will be left in private hands if they agree to recognize trade unions. Civil servants of the old imperial regime will keep their jobs if they agree to help out with the new democratic system. And these deals do work for a time. Or at least they work for as long as those old elements are staring right down the barrel of the possibility of a total overthrow by the workers, as they see happening in Russia. However, only a few years later, when the Weimar Republic is trying to live up to its idealistic beginnings, those same conservative reactionary forces still holding positions of power would be doing everything they could to work towards the overthrow of the Republic and the reestablishment of a conservative regime, a struggle that would encourage and open up a space for the rise of the Nazi Party. So in 1918, as the winter progresses, the ruling SDP does get support from the various workers' councils for a democratic vote for an elected assembly that would both draw up a new constitution and function as the new parliament. However, in December and January, the military, in a series of bloody conflicts, is suppressing the soldiers' workers' councils, taking back control of its forces, and since there are new rules about the size and behavior of the army, it is beginning to set up those paramilitary groups, the Freikorps, to destroy workers' councils around the country. The two major left-wing leaders, Karl Liebknecht and Rosa Luxemburg, are assassinated, and those killings mark the beginning of right-wing murders across the country. And these, sadly, are supported by the SDP. The defense minister, in response to workers' strikes, writes, quote, "Every person who is found fighting with arms in the hand against government troops is to be immediately shot." So, during this period of small-scale civil war, uprisings, and street battles, they hold the vote, and Germans turn up in record numbers. The big new unknown is the vote of women who are newly enfranchised, and it turns out they vote, by and large, for the conservative parties and the Catholic Center Party. However, the SDP form a minority coalition, but they are already in parliament with members who are already advocating for the abolition of that institution. To write the constitution, they leave Berlin and move to the old city of Weimar. Partly because of the ongoing street fighting between right-wing paramilitary groups and left-wing factions in the capital city, but also because they believe that the idea of the Weimar city, which in the 17th and 18th century was the center of the German Enlightenment and had been home to many literary figures and was now a kind of symbol of classical German culture, will help the new republic gain the moral support of conservative Germans. And so it begins, the Weimar Republic. Born out of high ideals and terrible, bloody compromises, out of struggle between old authority and the 19th and 20th century struggle for human rights, out of political extremism of the worst kind on both sides of the political divide, and out of a desire for national healing after what had been, up to that time, the most brutal, devastating war in human history. And in Weimar, despite their differences, on the 11th of August, 1919, the delegates come up with a document that protects basic liberties like freedom of speech and the press, declares the equality of women and men, establishes free and equal voting rights for all German citizens from the age of 21, makes collective bargaining between workers and industry legally binding, declares state responsibility for the unemployed and for mothers and children, and establishes Germany as a federal system of 18 states elected through proportional representation. It is a shining embodiment of the high ideals of the European democratic socialist movements, and at the same time moves Germany away from the totalitarian system of the USSR. Revolutions against authoritarian governments had swept across Germany for centuries, and finally a clear document had set their desires onto paper. But it also creates a fractured democracy with political groups at each other's throats, refusing all compromise, and with a parliament that was often completely blocked as members refused to work together and instead collaborated with groups outside the parliament who were trying to destroy the human rights that that parliament had been set up to uphold. And it set the stage for a right-wing demagogue to be legally elected, a demagogue who would then claim to be the only legitimate authority and would manipulate the rules in the Constitution to shut down the democratic process, which, sadly, brings me right back to the present, February 2024, and the big idea of this whole podcast series. That is, if some of these concerns and desires and fears seem familiar, well, they should be. Because I believe the Weimar Republic helped give birth to the modern world. Thank you for listening. Hit subscribe or follow if you want to know when the next episode appears. And I don't have any kind of advertising budget for this show. I'm just some obsessed singer repurposing a studio mic. So if you leave a review or hit a star button, it really encourages the podcast to be found by other listeners. So that'd be just great. And I hope you'll join me in the coming months as I explore more about the strange birth, life, and death of an experiment in creating a new society. I will put images for this episode onto my website, bremnersings.com, bremnersings.com. You'll see examples of the Sailors' Mutiny, the street fighting in Berlin between leftists and the right-wing Freikorps, the martyred leftist leaders Karl Liebknecht and Rosa Luxemburg. I have a nice picture of the Bavarian Soviet Republic, which kind of sounds like something from a science fiction novel with alternate timelines. And of course, the mad, brilliant general at the head of the German Imperial Military, Eric Ludendorff, who you have to see. He looks pretty much exactly like Central Casting had called down for an evil general. And who am I to discuss Weimar? Well, I am not a sociologist, a political scientist, or an historian. I am an obsessive artist, a singer, a playwright, and a cabaret performer who has been obsessed with the arts and music of the Weimar Republic all of my life. I've recorded 3 albums dedicated to the music of this time, and particularly the music of Kurt Weill. If you want to listen to any of them, just search for Bremner in any music streaming site and you will find all my albums. And if you want to know more about my work, or see the images from the period, or read the transcript of this episode, or suggest a specific Weimar subject which interests you for an episode, check out bremnersings.com, bremnersings.com. So join me next time for a walk through the amazing creative madness of 1920s Germany, and I'll do a first dive into the artistic revolutions that were inspired by that madness. Thanks. Bye.